This series deals with troubling topics including suicide, drug overdosing, and dependent adult abuse. If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, call or text 988 right now and speak with a counselor for free. Previously on The Quarterback and the Con Artist.
Eric lost Griffin to the heroin overdose, and I know that that caused Eric just unbelievable pain.
And that pain is amplified by the death of his mother and his father's sudden cancer diagnosis.
And to see that happen over about a 3-year period, it was a lot, man. It was a lot of, in a relatively short amount of time.
Growing up, Eric has an extremely complicated relationship with his dad.
Eric's father kind of guided this whole sports thing. He kind of lived through his son to the point of just overbearing and hanging out and trying to influence the coaches.
And Eric's relationship with his mother is equally fraught in an entirely different way.
So my mom, for me, was mostly somebody I feared.
Which is odd for a son to say about his mother.
Yeah, I think it must have felt for her like a prison sentence.
Like she did something wrong and now she's here.
Yeah, like she made one bad choice and now I'm paying for it every day.
I'm Jonathan Walton and this is The Quarterback and the Con Artist. Episode 5, Instant Attraction.
So my mom, she was not the most, here, let me fluff up your pillow for you. It was just a very cold approach.
Eric Kramer recalling what it was like being raised by his mom, Eileen.
I wasn't really close with her growing up. She was the disciplinarian, but I don't remember one real talk we had about life. Not one. Surely she had learned a lot about life in the course of her years that, you know, it would have been nice to go to lunch one day with her and have her just start asking questions about my life. That never happened. You know what I mean? Like, I just didn't have that kind of mom.
And you had friends who had mothers and you saw how their mothers treated them, and that was a stark contrast to how your mother treated you. And
several kids that their moms were a bit different than mine.
And you write in the book, "Mom had an aversion toward me. I felt that for one reason, one weird reason, I shared my dad's genes and I reminded her of him."
So she could be very icy toward my dad. So my dad might reach out to hold her hand and she's not reaching back. And I felt that iciness toward me at times. Sort of unmotherlike. Like, I didn't do anything other than be born, and I'm not him.
She was very stern and not a very warm, fuzzy.
Eric's childhood friend, Anna Durgan.
She didn't have these bouts of ups and downs or excitement in her voice. It was always monotone type of thing. I wouldn't say that she didn't like him, but I can see that there wasn't this type of, "Come here, my little child. Let me give you a hug and a kiss and all that other stuff. And how was your day today?" That wasn't Eileen at all.
I love you.
No.
No, I love you.
No. I didn't see it. Some people would say that she was cold. And that would be the impression that you could have gotten from her. But I don't think that. If you know her upbringing, her dad was very stern. And I think she just got some of those attributes from her dad that didn't allow her to show her true emotional vulnerabilities that she may have had.
And he never talked about this with you growing up?
Not at all.
Like deep,
we were kids. We don't talk about our parents like, "Oh, my mom and..." did this, or my dad did this. No, I don't think that we would be that open in talking about our parents if we had any, like, reservations about how they were treating us. It's all kept under the rug, or we were all quiet about it. We didn't talk about our upbringings as children. As adults, big difference now. We feel more confident. Yeah. It's okay to talk about it now. And as always, don't parents try to do something different than how their parents raised them?
Yeah, they absolutely do. But what young and impressionable Anna Durgan and Eric Kramer do not realize at the time, when they're kids, is that Eric's mom, Eileen, is actually going through a lot.
She was the hardest working person.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
She was working a full-time job, going to college to get her, finish up her degree, come home, take care of the house. Carl didn't do anything.
Eric's dad.
If the house needed painted, my sister got out there and painted the house. She had a lot on her shoulders, keeping that family together. And there were times when she wanted to throw in the towel, and then he talked the kids into, talk to your mom, I don't wanna, you know. So he used the kids kind of against my sister.
On more than one occasion, he would lament to me about problems of theirs. I was probably 12.
Like, he's talking about his marital problems.
Yeah. It's a heavy thing to lay on.
It is.
A 12-year-old.
But as Eric gets older, his mom also starts sharing problems she's having in the relationship too.
Yeah, I remember her, you know, she would be the one that cut my hair. She goes, I once told your dad that I wanted a divorce. She goes, this is back when you were young. And he told me that if I did that, he would kill himself.
This revelation, this suicide threat, ends up making Eric's mom stay in a deeply unhappy and stressful marriage.
She was loyal to us kids. She would not have wanted, even though she didn't respect my dad, didn't love him at that point in life, didn't want to be the cause of his death.
And eventually she was able to get her divorce, but yeah, it was painful.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
And the kids suffered for it. And I think Eric would say that he never felt enough approval from his mother. But she had to play the hard one, keeping a house and working and making sure the bills got paid because she couldn't depend on her husband. So I think she had to separate herself emotionally from her kids a little bit to keep.
As a way to cope.
Yes, yes. Plus being in a bad marriage. I mean, I have to give her credit. She hung in there as long as she could and raised those kids.
Eric is 20 years old, playing football at NC State when his mom and dad go their separate ways.
I remember when my mom told me that they were getting a divorce, internally, I thought, wow, it's about time.
You were happy.
Yeah, I really was. Only to have it be to the family dentist. Like, you know, that's who she ended up marrying.
The family dentist?
Doug.
Oh, I didn't know he was the family dentist.
Yeah.
Like, so this is a guy you're going to dentist as a kid?
As a kid.
Such a soap opera in this. She married the family dentist.
Yeah.
But while the end of Eric's parents' marriage is sad and depressing, the beginning, as you can imagine, is hopeful and exciting and filled with romance and endless possibilities. Just one look. Eileen and Carl first crossed paths in 1963 in the storied San Fernando Valley, a stone's throw from Los Angeles. Just One Look by Doris Troy is blaring from radios everywhere.
She was going to college. He had just gotten out of the service. He was in the Coast Guard for 4 years.
Eric's aunt, Patrice Cameron.
So instant attraction. They were quite taken with each other, and she fell for him pretty hard, and seemingly he did her. And they only went together a few months, and then their friends talked him into eloping in Las Vegas. So my sister tried to keep it a secret from my parents, and unbeknownst to her, our local paper used to print out the marriages from Vegas, and her name and Carl's name was in the paper, and...
And overnight, everyone finds out about this secret marriage between Eileen and Carl, and while no one is particularly thrilled about it, they all eventually get over it and move on. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, mostly because I think dispensaries are a little overwhelming and pretentious. That's just me. You do you. But there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people can buy cannabis. You know how most dispensaries make you choose between strains with ridiculous names and you have no idea which one's for you? Well, that's what Mood.com figured out. And by the way, you can get 20% off your first order with promo code Walton. If you go to Mood.com and click Shop by Mood, it'll tell you which strain does what. Want to be more social at a party? There's a flower for that. Need to focus and get work done? There's a flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, there's a flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and arrives in a discreet box. Best of all, everything's backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code Walton. So head to Mood.com and get 20% off your first order now.
My sister never got a proper wedding after that, so...
Did you like Carl for your sister?
I did. He was a very nice, like I say, charming person, very good looking, so there wasn't anything not to like about him. Everything seemed fine as far as we were concerned.
But as the years pass, the discord between these two disparate people grows. Eric's mom starts working all kinds of hours to support the family, and Eric's dad can't seem to hold down a job for very long.
You're fired.
Causing a lot of strife and misery all around. But the family's unhappiness isn't obvious from the outside looking in.
They look like the perfect couple, right? Like they got along and everything, but it wasn't that way at all. That was just a facade to kind of hide the fact that there was this trouble going on with their marriage.
So after Eric's mom divorces his dad and marries the family dentist, and as Eric grows up and starts achieving fame and success as a celebrated NFL quarterback...
Have you ever seen Eric Kramer any better?
No, not really. Eric had a great game. Now quit doubting him, Bernie, okay? Eric had a great game. He knew what he had to do, you know?
Eric's mom, Eileen, is extremely proud of her son.
There was a time when I felt like she wanted to show me off as though I was a new car.
You see, Eric's mom was a huge sports fan too, just like his dad. And she was also an athlete in her own right. She played every sport in high school and college, and she coached. She even got her degree in physical education. Though she sort of stayed out of Eric's sports endeavors when he was a kid.
You could almost think of this as two different teams. Like, my dad drafted me first, she drafted my sister first.
But when it came to her own athletic pursuits,
she had a certain never-say-die attitude.
Eric's mom, Eileen, was hardcore.
She got up at 5 o'clock every morning and she would play racquetball for a couple of hours before she'd go to work.
You know, there was many, many mornings where my dad, he'd be, you know, he's the one that took me to school. So she'd be up and gone to play racquetball at 5 a.m.
Eric remains somewhat distant from his mom for most of his life. They're friendly, they're cordial, they're just not close. Then, a tragic twist of fate changes everything.
When I really got to know my mom was when she got sick. She had stage 4 uterine cancer. Once she got sick, you know, it was just her and I. And I got to see a side of her that prior to that I didn't see before.
Like a softer, more maternal, kinder, gentler side.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so.
My sister was diagnosed with cancer and she aggressively tried to fight it. She had this year, I called it the golden year. She had 1 year that she survived, and she did her best to make amends with her kids. And I encouraged Eric to see his mother as much as he could. He did a lot with her, just one-on-one, and her daughter the same thing. And so they were able to really have some quality time with her mother in that last year. She was of the mindset at that time to appreciate everything. All of the other stuff was gone. It didn't matter anymore. It was her relationship with her kids that mattered. And she made the most of it. So I was very grateful that she was able to survive that last year and have some good times with her kids.
It changed her that last year.
It did change her. It took the edge off of things.
Eric and his mom get closer than they've ever been during the last year of her life. And when she dies, he understandably takes it really hard, especially considering his son, Griffin, had just died 9 months earlier. And Eric's feeling of loss gets amplified 100-fold because shortly after the death of his mom, Eric gets closer than he's ever been to his dad. Then his dad is stricken with cancer and admitted into hospice care. And Eric is suddenly swimming in this toxic mix of grief and isolation. His mom and son are gone, and now his dad is about to leave him too. And all that loss over such a short period of time suddenly flips a switch in Eric's brain.
And I think, unfortunately, that's what got me down the road I went down. I remember researching online, what's the best way to kill yourself?
So now you all know exactly what led Eric Kramer to pull the trigger that day, back on August 18th, 2015. What do you remember about that moment when you put the gun under your chin? Do you remember that moment?
No, I don't.
Because now I can see the scar.
Mm-hmm.
And now I didn't know the whole top of the head was blown off. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that tracks, because like a bullet went through your head.
He still cannot have an MRI because he has metal fragments in his head.
Eric's childhood friend, Anna Durgan.
Yeah, they weren't able to get it all out. In fact, when I spoke with his doctor, they had to sew him up on an emergency basis. They didn't think he was going to make it through the night. Like, they basically wrote him off like he's going to die.
But Eric Kramer doesn't die. He survives, which is just incredible.
Most of these injuries are usually critical injuries.
Dr. Mark Kerner is one of the emergency room surgeons working feverishly to save Eric's life the night he's brought into the ER at Northridge Hospital. Dr. Kerner manages to stop the bleeding, and he actually rebuilds parts of Eric's face.
All the facial reconstructions me.
Like, you reconstructed the skull.
Well, and the facial bones,
the face
and the
bones.
Nose and
wow.
The jaw. Yeah.
I can't even imagine how you do that. Under that kind of pressure, like a man's life is hanging in the balance and you're going in there to cut and snip and rebuild. That's a lot of pressure.
It's interesting because from my perspective, it's not really pressure because it's what I do. And so I'm so used to doing it, and I've done these things so many times. The thing you have to do when you're approaching these is, one, stay calm yourself so that everyone remember I'm the captain of the ship in the operating room. So everyone else has to follow my lead. So if I'm frenetic and not comfortable what I'm doing, no one else is. So you got to make sure that you're under control and you're in complete control of the situation, and I'm leading the charge of what we're going to do.
And Dr. Kerner does an amazing job because Eric leaves that operating room alive and intact. But
what will his mental status be like going forward? Is he going to end up with anoxic brain injury and be like a vegetable? Is he going to be functioning? Is he going to be... So that you can't tell, obviously, until much later. But he was moving all extremities and he was responding.
So Eric Kramer is alive, but he's not well when he wakes up in that hospital bed. The computer that is his brain is not completely functioning. It's sort of like it got a reboot. Now, everything's not loading back up the way it should. His basic life functions are there, but everything else just isn't working.
He had to learn how to walk. He had to learn how to talk. He had to learn how to eat.
Eric's childhood friend, Anna Durgan.
They basically said he has to learn everything again, and you have to think of him like a baby. They said this in front of him. It was myself, his sister Kelly, and his aunt Patrice, and we're meeting with this speech therapist. And she said it right in front of him. I thought for sure he was going to get pissed, but nothing happened. It didn't affect him. We were pissed at the way she said it in front of him. But now we understand why. She knew nothing was penetrating him. So that's why he didn't react. He didn't react at all.
Eric stays at Northridge Hospital for 6 weeks.
And then we transferred him over to UCLA Brain Rehabilitation Center because they have an extensive, really good brain rehabilitation, and that's what he needs. And I remember one time waiting in the waiting room. All I'm doing is researching all the different levels of brain trauma, this and that, so forth, doing YouTube, people who've had traumatic brain injuries, who've had their frontal lobe damage, everything I could do to educate myself and educate the family and give them hope. And I was sending them video. Look, this person had this kind of injury, and look at them. They're functioning today and so forth. So, because it was very gloomy.
Well, it was a little scary in the beginning.
Eric's close friend, Robert Espinosa.
You know, going to see him, it was fresh after it had happened, and he was, you know, on like a machine, basically, and he had a big concave in his head. And as he started to come out a little more and was able to, I'd wheel him outside in a wheelchair, I'd turn on some music, and we would just chill and talk. But he was not so responsive, but I knew that the songs he'd like when I played them, you know, bob his head a little bit. As he started improving, we'd try to take turns and have people go visit him, just, you know, so he would at least see people he would remember, even though sometimes he wouldn't remember it after. Like, if I was going, I would tell Anna so she would know she didn't have to go that day, and I would do dinner with him. But sometimes we would overlap and he would forget I already took him to dinner, and then he would go to dinner with Anna. And so his memory wasn't all there. But if I brought him food, there was times he ate two dinners because he just wasn't aware that, didn't remember eating, and somebody else would come in. And he also didn't experience hunger. And so if he went out and ate, he would just eat to eat. And then later, somebody else would come by and, hey, I brought you a hamburger. Oh, cool. And he would just eat again.
Eventually, Eric is well enough to leave the brain rehab facility he's in, and he goes home. But he needs a lot of help. So Anna Durgan steps up to the plate.
I lived at his house with him, and I would take him in every morning to go get treatment. He was always being cared for 24/7. Someone was always supervising him.
And after a few months, Eric enters a recovery facility in Las Vegas, fully equipped to meet all his needs.
We moved him to Vegas because I couldn't keep this up. You know, I had a full-time job and I was making it work. We said, okay, let's move you to Vegas with his sister Kelly because she works at night, so she could be with him during the day when she's at work. Her boys, teenage boys, can be with him at night because they needed 24-hour supervision. So I would go out and visit after I dropped him off driving and drop him off. I'd go every other weekend.
At this point, Eric can walk, he can drive a car, he can play a round of golf. He looks like a regular functioning man. But mentally, he's got the brain capacity of a 6-year-old, and he cannot take care of himself.
Eric's demeanor throughout his recovery was childlike. He would sit in front of a TV for 7 to 8 hours without ever getting up to go to use the restroom, without eating. It was like the TV was hypnotizing him. He didn't have his forehead. It was completely gone. There was no forehead. The forehead that he has right now, it's plastic, a very hard plastic. He would have to wear this helmet. One day he takes off the helmet, looks in the mirror at himself, brushes his fingers over his head, and goes, "Huh, I wonder what happened there." And then just put the helmet back on and went back to watching TV. Nothing like a child wouldn't know to say. It was devastating, by the way, seeing any person without a forehead. Like, shocking. It was like, oh my God. You still wonder, how can this person even be alive and walking and talking? And the old Eric was there.
Eric's forehead eventually gets replaced with a plastic prosthetic underneath the skin that looks really real. And all his wounds heal. And on the outside, he starts looking like himself again. But on the inside, he's still not there mentally. He just doesn't have the ability to understand things and react to things.
Well, we were always scared to say anything to him. We didn't know when he was recovering what we could and could not say. I'm like, he didn't even know he attempted to take his own life. He wasn't aware why he was going to the doctors for a year and a half.
But it's important to point out here that if you don't know Eric Kramer around this time, like if you just see him in public, he appears totally normal. But if you watch him for a while, the way he interacts with people, the way he carries himself, you'd be able to tell that something is off.
He couldn't really stay focused on one thing.
Robert Espinosa.
Like if I went over there and we would be watching TV, he watches games completely through. And a commercial would come and he'd change it. And then he'd start watching a TV program and forget about the game. So he was like constantly changing the TV. That would be something like a kid. I mean, he still spoke like a man. He responded. He would ignore you like a kid sometimes, but he was... there was times where he would just not acknowledge you or speak.
There were also times Eric wouldn't acknowledge his own basic needs.
And we decided to go play basketball.
Anna Durgan.
It's already getting hot in Vegas. It's like 90-something. He's wearing a sweatshirt. We're in tank tops. He's sweating. And we're like, okay, why isn't he taking off his sweatshirt? He's literally drenched, red, everything. Hey, Eric, why don't you take off your sweatshirt? No, it's okay. I go, but Eric, it's really hot. You're sweating. You're red. Oh, okay. And then he took it off. It was like his brain wasn't communicating with the rest of his body. And just like with it eating, his brain wasn't telling him that he was hungry. So unless you've forced him to eat with everybody or eat and put food in front of him, he wouldn't eat. He was stuck. He was stuck to the TV and stuck to the phone. So I literally had to go in there, it's very much like a child, and break the hypnotic state that he was in and bring him to eat in the kitchen.
Command of even the most basic executive functions of his own body elude him again and again and again.
We were at a barbecue. It was the residential house where he was being supervised and getting his treatment for the brain rehabilitation. We're all sitting, talking, having stories, whatever. We were sitting there for a while, and very much like a child when you start shaking your leg, right? Like you have to go to the bathroom. And I noticed it, and I see, you know, quietly go over and whisper in his ear, "Do you have to use the restroom?" And he said, "Yes." I go, "Oh, it's okay. Get up and you can go." And he dashed and went right up. Now, it's hard to see that from a grown man, but I'm trying to get people to understand that was his mental state, very much like a child.
And at that point, is it fair to say that whatever you told him to do, he just did it?
For the most part, yeah.
And around this time, when Eric is most vulnerable, a woman from his past suddenly appears. Her name is Courtney Baird. She's an attractive blonde in her early 40s who actually dates Eric a couple years earlier. But by all accounts, it was a toxic and unhealthy relationship. And when Eric finally breaks up with her, his friends and family are thrilled.
I never liked her for him.
Robert Espinosa.
I can see that she was a gold digger and she was just wanted a prestigious life and she didn't want to work for it, so she was going to find another way. I could just see that she's that type of woman.
But when Courtney finds out Eric is now living in Las Vegas and is suffering from diminished mental capacity, she immediately offers to help. And if you know anything about how con artists operate, then you know offering to help is 9 times out of 10 exactly how they gain entry into your life.
We would not think that anybody would be coming in here and trying to steal from him. That would just be cruel.
If you or someone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, call or text 988 right now and speak with a counselor for free. If you're enjoying The Quarterback and the Con Artist, click that share button right now and text it to your friends and family. And if you can, leave us a 5-star review. The Quarterback and the Con Artist is produced, written, and hosted by me, Jonathan Walton, for Jonathan Walton Media. Executive producers Eric Kramer and Anna Durgan. Audio engineering by Justin Longerbeam. Editing and sound design by Hansdale Shi. Legal counsel provided by Ken Sterling from Sterling Media Law. We've got a lot of incredible stories in the works at Jonathan Walton Media, so make sure you subscribe and keep an ear out.